are, in terms of their content, almost identical. We saw earlier that the just values of outrage and punitive intent were almost perfectly correlated, as implied by the outrage hypothesis. The ratings of punitive intent and the dollar awards answer precisely the same question: how severely general assistance should be punished in different units. How can we explain the large differences seen in Figure 13? We can probably agree that outrage is not a very precise scale. True, there is such a thing as completely acceptable behavior. But if there is a limit to how angry you can get at general assistance or at the other defendants, that limit is rather vague. What does it mean for a behavior to be absolutely outrageous? The lack of clarity on the upper end of the scale makes some noise inevitable. Punitive intent is more specific. Severe punishment is more precise than absolutely outrageous, because an extremely severe punishment is bounded by the maximum prescribed by the law. You may wish to throw the book at the culprit, but you may not, for instance, recommend putting the CEO of General Assistance and its entire executive team to death. We hope. The punitive intent scale is less ambiguous because its upper bound is more clearly specified. As we might expect, it is also less noisy. Outrage and punitive intent were both measured on similar rating scales, defined more or less clearly by verbal labels. The dollar scale belongs to a different family, which is far more problematic. Dollars and anchors. The title of our academic paper expresses its central message: Shared Outrage and Erratic Awards, The Psychology of Punitive Damages. There was a fair amount of agreement among our experimental jurors in their ratings of punitive intent. The ratings were mostly explained by outrage. However, the dollar measure most closely simulated the courtroom situation, and it was unacceptably noisy. The reason is not mysterious. If you actually generated a specific dollar amount of damages in the Joan Glover case, you surely experienced the feeling that your choice of a number was essentially arbitrary. The feeling of arbitrariness conveys important information. It tells you that other people will make widely different arbitrary decisions and that the judgments will be very noisy. This turns out to be a characteristic of the family of scales to which dollar awards belong. The legendary Harvard psychologist S.S. Stevens discovered the surprising fact that people share strong intuitions about the ratios of intensity of many subjective experiences and attitudes. They can adjust a light so that it appears twice as bright as another, and they agree that the emotional significance of a 10-month prison sentence is not nearly 10 times as bad as that of a sentence of 1 month. Stevens called scales that draw on such intuitions ratio scales. You can tell that our intuitions about money are expressed in ratios from the ease with which we understand such expressions as, "Sarah got a 60% raise," or, "Our rich neighbor lost half his wealth overnight." The dollar scale of punitive damages is a ratio scale for the measurement of the intention to punish. Like other ratio scales, it has a meaningful zero, $0, and is unbounded at the top. Stevens discovered that a ratio scale, like the dollar scale, can be tied down by a single intermediate anchor. The jargon term is modulus. In his laboratory, he would expose observers to a light of a certain brightness, with the instruction to call the brightness of that light 10, or 50, or 200, and assign numbers to the other brightnesses accordingly. As expected, the numbers that observers assigned to lights of different brightness were proportional to the arbitrary anchor they were instructed to adopt. An observer who was anchored on the number 200 would make judgments that were 20 times higher than if the anchor had been 10. The standard deviation of the observer's judgments would also be proportional to the anchor. In Chapter 13, we described an amusing example of anchoring, in which people's willingness to pay for an object was strongly influenced by asking them first if they would pay in dollars the last two digits of their Social Security number. A more striking result was that the initial anchor also affected their willingness to pay for a whole list of other objects. Participants who were induced to agree to pay a large amount for a cordless trackball agreed to pay a correspondingly larger amount for a cordless keyboard. It appears that people are much more sensitive to the relative value of comparable goods than to their absolute value. The authors of the study named the persistent effect of a single anchor coherent arbitrariness. To appreciate the effect of an arbitrary anchor in the Joan Glover case, suppose that the text at the beginning of this chapter included the following information. In a similar case involving another pharmaceutical company, a little girl who was the victim suffered moderate psychological trauma, as in the mild harm version you listened to earlier. The punitive damages were set at $1.5 million. Notice that the problem of setting a punishment for general assistance has suddenly become much easier. Indeed, an amount may have come to your mind already. There is a multiplier or ratio of the dollar awards that corresponds to the contrast between the severe harm that was done to Joan and the mild harm suffered by the other little girl. Furthermore, the single anchor you heard, $1.5 million, is sufficient to tie down the entire dollar scale of punishment. It is now easy for you to set damages for cases both more severe and milder than the two considered so far. If anchors are required to make judgments on a ratio scale, what happens when people are not given an anchor? Stevens reported the answer. In the absence of guidance from the experimenter, people are forced to make an arbitrary choice when they use the scale for the first time. From that point, they make their judgments consistently, using their first answer as an anchor. You may recognize the task you faced in setting damages for the Joan Glover case as an instance of scaling without an anchor. Like the anchorless observers in Stevens' lab, you made an arbitrary decision about the correct punishment for general assistance. The participants in our study of punitive damages faced the same problem. They were also compelled to make an initial arbitrary decision about the first case they saw. Unlike you, however, they did not just make one arbitrary decision. They went on to set punitive damages for 9 other cases. These 9 judgments were not arbitrary because they could be made consistent with the initial anchoring judgment and therefore with one another. The findings of Stevens' laboratory suggest that the anchor that individuals produce should have a large effect on the absolute values of their subsequent dollar judgments, but no effect whatsoever on the relative positions of the 10 cases. A large initial judgment causes all the other judgments to be proportionately large without affecting their relative size. This reasoning leads to a surprising conclusion. Although they appear hopelessly noisy, dollar judgments actually reflect the judge's punitive intentions. To discover these intentions, we need only replace the absolute dollar values with relative scores. To test this idea, we repeated the analysis of noise after replacing each dollar award by its rank among an individual's 10 judgments. The highest dollar award was scored 1, the next highest was scored 2, and so forth. This transformation of dollar awards to ranks eliminates all juror-level errors, because the 1 to 10 distribution of ranks is the same for everyone, except for occasional ties. In case you wondered, there were multiple versions of the questionnaire because each individual judged 10 of the 28 scenarios. We conducted the analysis separately for each group of participants who had responded to the same 10 scenarios, and we report an average. The results were striking. The proportion of noise in the judgments dropped from 94% to 49%. Figure 14 on the bonus PDF. Transforming the dollar awards into rankings revealed that jurors were actually in substantial agreement about the appropriate punishment in different cases. Indeed, the rankings of dollar awards were, if anything, slightly less noisy than the original ratings of punitive intent. An unfortunate conclusion. The results are consistent with the theory we have outlined. Dollar awards for all cases were anchored on the arbitrary number that each juror picked for the first case they saw. The relative ranking of cases reflects attitudes with fair accuracy and is thus not very noisy. But the absolute values of the dollar awards are essentially meaningless because they depend on the arbitrary number chosen in the first case. Ironically, the case that jurors assess in real trials is the first and only one they see. American legal practice requires civil juries to set a dollar award for one case, without the benefit of any guiding anchor. The law explicitly prohibits any communication to the jury of the size of punitive awards in other cases. The assumption implicit in the law is that jurors' sense of justice will lead them directly from a consideration of an offense to the correct punishment. This assumption is psychological nonsense. It assumes an ability that humans do not have. The institutions of justice should acknowledge the limitations of the people who administer it. The example of punitive damages is extreme. Professional judgments are rarely expressed on scales that are so hopelessly ambiguous. Nonetheless, ambiguous scales are common, which means that the punitive damages study holds two general lessons, applicable in business, education, sports, government, and elsewhere. First, the choice of a scale can make a large difference in the amount of noise in judgments, because ambiguous scales are noisy. Second, replacing absolute judgments with relative ones when feasible is likely to reduce noise. Speaking of scales, there is a lot of noise in our judgments. Could this be because we understand the scale differently? Can we agree on an anchor case that will serve as a reference point on the scale? To reduce noise, maybe we should replace our judgments with a ranking. Chapter 16. Patterns. Remember Julie, the precocious child whose college GPA you tried to guess in Chapter 14? Here is a fuller description. Julie was an only child. Her father was a successful lawyer, her mother an architect. When Julie was about 3 years old, her father contracted an autoimmune disease that forced him to work at home. He spent a lot of time with Julie and patiently taught her to read. She was reading fluently when she was 4 years old. Her dad also tried to teach her arithmetic, but she found that topic difficult. Julie was a good pupil in elementary school, but she was emotionally needy and rather unpopular. She spent much time alone and became a passionate birdwatcher after being inspired by watching birds with her favorite uncle. Her parents divorced when she was 11, and Julie took the divorce hard. Her grades plummeted, and she had frequent outbursts at school. In high school, she did very well in some subjects, including biology and creative writing. She surprised everyone by excelling in physics. But she neglected most of her other subjects, and she graduated from high school a B student. Not admitted to the prestigious schools to which she applied, Julie eventually attended a good state school, where she majored in environmental studies. During her first 2 years in college, she continued a pattern of frequent emotional entanglements and smoked pot fairly regularly. In her fourth semester, however, she developed a strong wish to go to medical school and began to take her work much more seriously. What is your best guess about Julie's graduating GPA? Problems, hard and easy. Obviously, this problem, let's call it Julie 2.0, has become much more difficult. All you knew about Julie 1.0 was that she could read when she was four. With only one cue, the power of matching did the work, and an intuitive estimate of her GPA came quickly to mind. Matching would still be available if you had several cues that pointed in the same general direction. For instance, when you heard a description of Bill, the jazz-playing accountant, all the information you had, unimaginative, strong in mathematics, weak in social studies, painted a coherent, stereotypical picture. Similarly, if most of the events in the life of Julie 2.0 were consistent with a story of precociousness and superior achievement, with perhaps a few data points suggesting merely average performance, you would not find the task so difficult. When the evidence available paints a coherent picture, our fast System 1 thinking has no difficulty making sense of it. Simple judgment problems like these are easily resolved, and most people agree on their solution. Not so with Julie 2.0. What makes this problem difficult is the presence of multiple conflicting cues. There are indications of ability and motivation, but also of character weaknesses and mediocre achievement. The story seems to be all over the place. It does not easily make sense because the elements cannot be fit in a coherent interpretation. Of course, the incoherence does not make the story unrealistic or even implausible. Life is often more complex than the stories we like to tell about it. Multiple conflicting cues create the ambiguity that defines difficult judgment problems. Ambiguity also explains why complex problems are noisier than simple ones. The rule is simple. If there is more than one way to see anything, people will vary in how they see it. People can pick different pieces of evidence to form the core of their narrative, so there are many possible conclusions. If you found it difficult to construct a story that makes sense of Julie 2.0, you can be quite certain that other listeners will construct different stories that justify judgments other than yours. This is the variability that produces pattern noise. When do you feel confident in a judgment? Two conditions must be satisfied. The story you believe must be comprehensively coherent, and there must be no attractive alternatives. Comprehensive coherence is achieved when all the details of the chosen interpretation fit with the story and reinforce each other. Of course, you can also achieve coherence, albeit less elegantly, by ignoring or explaining away whatever does not fit. It is the same with alternative interpretations. The true expert who has solved a judgment problem knows not only why her explanatory story is correct, she is equally fluent in explaining why other stories are wrong. Here again, a person can gain confidence of equal strength, but poorer quality by failing to consider alternatives or by actively suppressing them. The main implication of this view of confidence is that subjective confidence in one's judgment by no means guarantees accuracy. Moreover, the suppression of alternative interpretations, a well-documented process in perception, could induce what we have called the illusion of agreement. See Chapter 2. If people cannot imagine possible alternatives to their conclusions, they will naturally assume that other observers must reach the same conclusion too. Of course, few of us have the good fortune of being highly confident about all our judgments, and all of us have had the experience of uncertainty, perhaps as recently as you're listening about Julie 2.0. We are not all highly confident all the time. But most of the time, we are more confident than we should be. Pattern noise, stable or transient. We have defined a pattern error as an error in an individual's judgment of a case that cannot be explained by the sum of the separate effects of the case and the judge. An extreme example may be the normally lenient judge who is unusually severe in sentencing a particular kind of defendant. Say, people who have committed traffic offenses. Or, say, the normally cautious investor who drops his usual caution when shown the plan of an exciting startup. Of course, most pattern errors are not extreme. We observe a moderate pattern error in the lenient judge who is less lenient than usual when dealing with recidivists, or even more lenient than usual when sentencing young women. Pattern errors arise from a combination of transient and permanent factors. The transient factors include those we have described as sources of occasion noise, such as a judge's good mood at the relevant moment, or some unfortunate recent occurrence that is currently on the judge's mind. Other factors are more permanent. For example, an employer's unusual enthusiasm for people who attended certain universities, or a doctor's unusual propensity to recommend hospitalization for people with pneumonia. We can write a simple equation that describes an error in a single judgment. Pattern error equals stable pattern error plus transient occasion error. Because stable pattern error and transient occasion error are independent and uncorrelated, we can extend that equation to analyze their variances. pattern noise squared equals stable pattern noise squared plus occasion noise squared. As we did for other components of error and noise, we can represent this equation graphically as the sum of squares on the sides of a right triangle, figure 15 on the bonus PDF. For a simple case of stable pattern noise, consider recruiters who predict the future performance of executives on the basis of a set of ratings. In Chapter 9, we spoke of a model of the judge. The model of an individual recruiter assigns a weight to each rating, which corresponds to its importance in that recruiter's judgments. The weights vary among recruiters. Leadership may count more for one recruiter, communication skills for another. Such differences produce variability in the recruiter's ranking of candidates, an instance of what we call stable pattern noise. Personal reactions to individual cases can also produce patterns that are stable but highly specific. Consider what led you to pay more attention to some aspects of Julie's story than to others. Some details of the case may resonate with your life experience. Perhaps something about Julie reminds you of a close relative who kept almost succeeding but ultimately failing because of what you believe are deep character flaws that were evident since that relative's teenage years. Conversely, Julie's story may evoke memories of a close friend who, after a troubled adolescence, did make it to medical school and is now a successful specialist. The associations that Julie evokes in different people are idiosyncratic and unpredictable, but they are likely to be stable. If you had listened to Julie's story last week, you would have been reminded of the same people and would have seen her story in the same distinctively personal light. Individual differences in the quality of judgments are another source of pattern noise. Imagine a single forecaster with crystal ball powers that no one knows about, including herself. Her accuracy would make her deviate in many cases from the average forecast. In the absence of outcome data, these deviations would be regarded as pattern errors. When judgments are unverifiable, superior accuracy will look like pattern noise. Pattern noise also arises from systematic differences in the ability to make valid judgments about different dimensions of a case. Consider the process of selection for professional sports teams. Coaches may focus on skills and various aspects of the game, physicians on susceptibility to injuries, and psychologists on motivation and resilience. When these different specialists evaluate the same players, we can expect a considerable amount of pattern noise. Similarly, professionals in the same generalist role may be more skilled at some aspects of the judgment task than at others. In such cases, pattern noise is better described as variability in what people know than as error. When professionals make decisions on their own, variability in skills is simply noise. However, when management has the opportunity to construct teams that will reach judgments together, diversity of skills becomes a potential asset, because different professionals will cover different aspects of the judgment and complement one another. We discuss this opportunity and what is required to capture it in Chapter 21. In earlier chapters, we spoke of the two lotteries that face the client of an insurance company or the defendant who is assigned the judge who will try him. We can now see that the first lottery, which picks a professional from a group of colleagues, selects much more than the average level of that professional's judgments, the level error. The lottery also selects a kaleidoscopic assemblage of values, preferences, beliefs, memories, experiences, and associations that are unique to this particular professional. Whenever you make a judgment, you carry your own baggage too. You come with the habits of mind you formed on the job and the wisdom you gained from your mentors. You bring along the successes that built your confidence and the mistakes that you are careful not to repeat. And somewhere in your brain are the formal rules you remember, those you forgot, and those you learned that it is okay to ignore. No one is exactly like you in all these respects. Your stable pattern errors are unique to you. The second lottery is the one that picks the moment when you make your judgment, the mood you are in, and other extraneous circumstances that should not affect your judgment, but do. this lottery creates occasion noise. Imagine, for instance, that shortly before you read Julie's case, you read a newspaper article about drug use on college campuses. The piece featured the story of a gifted student who was determined to go to law school and worked hard, but was unable to make up for the deficit he had accumulated while using drugs in his early years of college. Because it is fresh in your mind, this story will lead you to pay more attention to Julie's pot-smoking habit in your assessment of her overall chances. However, you probably would not remember the article if you encountered the question about Julie in a couple of weeks, and you would obviously not have known about it if you had read the case yesterday. The effect of reading the newspaper article is transient. It is occasion noise. As this example illustrates, there is no sharp discontinuity between stable pattern noise and the unstable variant that we call occasion noise. The main difference is whether a person's unique sensitivity to some aspects of the case is itself permanent or transient. When the triggers of pattern noise are rooted in our personal experiences and values, we can expect the pattern to be stable, a reflection of our uniqueness. The personality analogy. The idea of uniqueness in the responses of particular people to certain features or combinations of features is not immediately intuitive. To understand it, we might consider another complex combination of features that we all know well: the personalities of people around us. In fact, the event of a judge making a judgment about a case should be seen as a special case of a broader topic that is the domain of personality research: how a person acts in a situation. There is something to be learned about judgment from the decades of intensive study of the broader topic. Psychologists have long sought to understand and measure individual differences in personality. People differ from one another in many ways. An early attempt to scan the dictionary for terms that may describe a person identified 18,000 words. Today, the dominant model of personality, the Big Five model, combines traits into five groupings: extroversion, agreeableness, conscientiousness, openness to experience, neuroticism, with each of the Big Five covering a range of distinguishable traits. A personality trait is understood as a predictor of actual behaviors. If someone is described as conscientious, we expect to observe some corresponding behaviors: arriving on time, keeping commitments, and so on. And if Andrew scores higher than Brad on a measure of aggressiveness, we should observe that in most situations, Andrew behaves more aggressively than Brad does. In fact, however, the validity of broad traits for predicting specific behaviors is quite limited. A correlation of 0.3, PC equals 60%, would be considered high. Common sense suggests that while behavior may be driven by personality, it is also strongly affected by situations. In some situations, no one is aggressive, and in other situations, everyone is. When consoling a bereaved friend, neither Andrew nor Brad will act aggressively. At a football game, however, both will display some aggression. In short, and unsurprisingly, behaviors are a function of personalities and of situations. What makes people unique and endlessly interesting is that this joining of personality and situation is not a mechanical additive function. For example, the situations that trigger more or less aggression are not the same for all people. Even if Andrew and Brad are equally aggressive on average, they do not necessarily display equal aggressiveness in every context. Perhaps Andrew is aggressive toward his peers, but docile with superiors, whereas Brad's level of aggressiveness is not sensitive to hierarchical level. Perhaps Brad is particularly prone to aggression when criticized, and unusually restrained when physically threatened. These signature patterns of response to situations are likely to be fairly stable over time. They constitute much of what we consider someone's personality, although they do not lend themselves to a description by a broad trait. Andrew and Brad may share the same score on a test of aggression, but they are unique in their pattern of response to aggression triggers and contexts. Two people who share a trait level, if, for example, they are equally obstinate or equally generous, should be described by two distributions of behaviors that have the same average, but not necessarily the same pattern of responses to different situations. You can now see the parallel between this discussion of personality and the model of judgment we have presented. Level differences between judges correspond to the differences among scores on personality traits, which represent an average of behaviors in multiple situations. Cases are analogous to situations. A person's judgment of a particular problem is only moderately predictable from that person's average level, just as specific behaviors are only moderately predictable from personality traits. The ranking of individuals by their judgment varies substantially from one case to another because people differ in their reaction to the features and combinations of features that they find in each case. The signature of an individual who makes judgments and decisions is a unique pattern of sensitivity to features and a correspondingly unique pattern in the judgment of cases. The uniqueness of personality is normally a cause for celebration. But this book is concerned with professional judgments, where variation is problematic and noise is error. The point of the analogy is that pattern noise in judgment is not random. Even if we have little hope of explaining it, and even if the individuals who make distinctive judgments could not explain them. Speaking of pattern noise, you seem confident in your conclusion, but this is not an easy problem. There are cues pointing in different directions. Have you overlooked alternative interpretations of the evidence? You and I have interviewed the same candidate, and usually we are equally demanding interviewers. Yet we have completely different judgments. Where does this pattern noise come from? The uniqueness of people's personalities is what makes them capable of innovation and creativity, and simply interesting and exciting to be around. When it comes to judgment, however, that uniqueness is not an asset. Chapter 17. The Sources of Noise. We hope that by now you agree that wherever there is judgment, there is noise. We also hope that for you there is no longer more of it than you think. This mantra about noise motivated us when we started our project, but our thinking about the topic has evolved over the years of working on it. We now review the main lessons we have learned about the components of noise, about their respective importance in the general picture of noise, and about the place of noise in the study of judgment. The components of noise. Figure 16 on the bonus PDF offers a combined graphical representation of the three equations we introduced in chapters 5, 6, and 16. The figure illustrates three successive breakdowns of error: error into bias and system noise, system noise into level noise and pattern noise into stable pattern noise, and occasion noise. Consulting the PDF, you can now see how MSE breaks down into the squares of bias and of the three components of noise we have discussed. When we began our research, we were focusing on the relative weights of bias and noise in total error. We soon concluded that noise is often a larger component of error than bias is, and certainly well worth exploring in more detail. Our early thinking on the constituents of noise was guided by the structure of complex noise audits, in which multiple people make individual judgments about multiple cases. The study of federal judges was an example, and the study of punitive damages another. Data from these studies provided solid estimates of level noise. On the other hand, because every participant judges every case, but does so only once, there is no way of telling whether the residual error, which we have called pattern error, is transient or stable. In the conservative spirit of statistical analysis, the residual error is commonly labeled an error term and is treated as random. In other words, the default interpretation of pattern noise is that it consists entirely of occasion noise. This conventional interpretation of pattern noise as random error constrained our thinking for a long time. It seemed natural to focus on level noise, the consistent differences between harsh and lenient judges, or between optimistic and pessimistic forecasters. We were also intrigued by evidence of the influence on judgments of the irrelevant and transient circumstances that create occasion noise. The evidence gradually led us to realize that the noisy judgments that different people make are largely determined by something that is neither a general bias of the individual nor transient and random. The persistent personal reactions of particular individuals to a multitude of features, which determine their reactions to specific cases. We eventually concluded that our default assumption about the transient nature of pattern noise should be abandoned. Though we want to be careful not to overgeneralize from what remains a limited selection of examples, the studies we have assembled, taken together, suggest that stable pattern noise is actually more significant than the other components of system noise. Because we rarely have a full picture of the components of error in the same study, it requires some triangulation to formulate this tentative conclusion. In short, here is what we know, and what we don't. Sizing the components. First, we have several estimates of the relative weights of level noise and pattern noise. Overall, it appears that pattern noise contributes more than level noise. In the insurance company of Chapter 2, for instance, differences between underwriters in the average of the premiums they set accounted for only 20% of total system noise. The remaining 80% was pattern noise. Among the federal judges of Chapter 6, level noise, differences in average severity, represented slightly less than half of total system noise. Pattern noise was the larger component. In the punitive damages experiment, the total amount of system noise varied widely depending on the scale used: punitive intent, outrage, or damages in dollars. But the share of pattern noise in that total was roughly constant. It accounted for 63%, 62%, and 61% of total system noise for the three scales used in the study. Other studies we will review in Part 5, notably on personnel decisions, are consistent with this tentative conclusion. The fact that in these studies level noise is generally not the larger component of system noise is already an important message, because level noise is the only form of noise that organizations can, sometimes, monitor without conducting noise audits. When cases are assigned more or less randomly to individual professionals, the differences in the average level of their decisions provide evidence of level noise. For example, studies of patent offices observed large differences in the average propensity of examiners to grant patents, with subsequent effects on the incidence of litigation about these patents. Similarly, case officers in child protection services vary in their propensity to place children in foster care, with long-term consequences for the children's welfare. These observations are based solely on an estimation of level noise. If there is more pattern noise than level noise, then these already shocking findings understate the magnitude of the noise problem by at least a factor of 2. There are exceptions to this tentative rule. The scandalous variability in the decisions of asylum judges is almost certainly due more to level noise than to pattern noise, which we suspect is large as well. The next step is to analyze pattern noise by separating its two components. There are good reasons to assume that stable pattern noise, rather than occasion noise, is the dominant component. The audit of the sentences of federal judges illustrates our reasoning. Start with the extreme possibility that all pattern noise is transient. On that assumption, sentencing would be unstable and inconsistent over time, to an extent that we find implausible. We would have to expect that the average difference between judgments of the same case by the same judge on different occasions is about 2.8 years. The variability of average sentencing among judges is already shocking. The same variability in the sentences of an individual judge over occasions would be grotesque. It seems more reasonable to conclude that judges differ in their reactions to different defendants and different crimes, and that these differences are highly personal but stable. To quantify more precisely how much of pattern noise is stable and how much is occasion noise, we need studies in which the same judges make two independent assessments of each case. As we have noted, obtaining two independent judgments is generally impossible in studies of judgment, because it is difficult to guarantee that the second judgment of a case is truly independent of the first. Especially when the judgment is complex, there is a high probability that the individual will recognize the problem and repeat the original judgment. A group of researchers at Princeton, led by Alexander Todorov, has designed clever experimental techniques to overcome this problem. They recruited participants from Amazon Mechanical Turk, a site where individuals provide short-term services, such as answering questionnaires, and are paid for their time. In one experiment, participants viewed pictures of faces, generated by a computer program but perfectly indistinguishable from the faces of real people, and rated them on various attributes, such as likability and trustworthiness. The experiment was repeated with the same faces and the same respondents 1 week later. It is fair to expect less consensus in this experiment than in professional judgments such as those of sentencing judges. Everyone might agree that some people are extremely attractive and that others are extremely unattractive. But across a significant range, we expect reactions to faces to be largely idiosyncratic. Indeed, there was little agreement among observers. On the ratings of trustworthiness, for instance, differences among pictures accounted for only 18% of the variance of judgments. The remaining 82% of the variance was noise. It is also fair to expect less stability in these judgments, because the quality of judgments made by participants who are paid to answer questions online is often substantially lower than in professional settings. Nevertheless, the largest component of noise was stable pattern noise. The second largest component of noise was level noise, that is, differences among observers in their average ratings of trustworthiness. Occasion noise, though still substantial, was the smallest component. The researchers reached the same conclusions when they asked participants to make other judgments, about preferences among cars or foods, for example, or on questions that are closer to what we call professional judgments. For instance, in a replication of the study of punitive damages discussed in Chapter 15, participants rated their punitive intent in 10 cases of personal injury, on two separate occasions, separated by a week. Here again, stable pattern noise was the largest component. In all these studies, individuals generally did not agree with one another, but they remained quite stable in their judgments. This consistency without consensus, in the researchers' words, provides clear evidence of stable pattern noise. The strongest evidence for the role of stable patterns comes from the large study of bail judges we mentioned in Chapter 10. In one part of this exceptional study, the authors created a statistical model that simulated how each judge used the available cues to decide whether to grant bail. They built custom-made models of 173 judges. Then they applied these simulated judges to make decisions about 141,833 cases, yielding 173 decisions for each case. A total of more than 24 million decisions. At our request, the authors generously carried a special analysis in which they separated the variance judgments into three components: the true variance of the average decisions for each of the cases, the level noise created by differences among judges in their propensity to grant bail, and the remaining pattern noise. This analysis is relevant to our argument because pattern noise, as measured in this study, is entirely stable. The random variability of occasion noise is not represented because this is an analysis of models that predict a judge's decision. Only the verifiably stable individual rules of prediction are included. The conclusion was unequivocal. This stable pattern noise was almost four times larger than level noise, Stable pattern noise accounted for 26%, and level noise 7% of total variance. The stable, idiosyncratic, individual patterns of judgment that could be identified were much larger than the differences in across-the-board severity. All this evidence is consistent with the research on occasion noise that we reviewed in Chapter 7. While the existence of occasion noise is surprising and even disturbing, there is no indication that within-person variability is larger than between-person differences. The most important component of system noise is the one we had initially neglected, stable pattern noise, the variability among judges in their judgments of particular cases. Given the relative scarcity of relevant research, our conclusions are tentative, but they do reflect a change in how we think about noise and about how to tackle it. In principle, at least, level noise, or simple across-the-board differences between judges, should be a relatively easy problem to measure and address. If there are abnormally tough graders, cautious child custody officers, or risk-averse loan officers, the organizations that employ them could aim to equalize the average level of their judgments. Universities, for instance, address this problem when they require professors to abide by a predetermined distribution of grades within each class. Unfortunately, as we now realize, focusing on level noise misses a large part of what individual differences are about. Noise is mostly a product not of level differences, but of interactions. How different judges deal with particular defendants, how different teachers deal with particular students, how different social workers deal with particular families, how different leaders deal with particular visions of the future. Noise is mostly a byproduct of our uniqueness, of our judgment personality. Reducing level noise is still a worthwhile objective, but attaining only this objective would leave most of the problem of system noise without a solution. Explaining error. We found a lot to say about noise, but the topic is almost entirely absent from public awareness and from discussions of judgment and error. Despite the evidence of its presence and the multiple mechanisms that produce it, noise is rarely mentioned as a major factor in judgment. How is this possible? Why do we never invoke noise to explain bad judgments, whereas we routinely blame biases? Why is it so unusual to give much thought to noise as a source of error, despite its ubiquity? The key to this puzzle is that although the average of errors, the bias, and the variability of errors, the noise, play equivalent roles in the error equation, we think about them in profoundly different ways. And our ordinary way of making sense of the world around us makes it all but impossible to recognize the role of noise. Earlier in this book, we noted that we easily make sense of events in hindsight, although we could not have predicted them before they happened. In the Valley of the Normal, events are unsurprising and easily explained. The same can be said of judgments. Like other events, judgments and decisions mostly happen in the Valley of the Normal. They usually do not surprise us. For one thing, judgments that produce satisfactory outcomes are normal and seldom questioned. When the shooter who is picked for the free kick scores the goal, when the heart surgery is successful, or when a startup prospers, we assume that the reasons the decision makers had for their choices must have been the right ones. After all, they have been proven right. Like any other unsurprising story, a success story explains itself once the outcome is known. We do, however, feel a need to explain abnormal outcomes, the bad ones and occasionally the surprisingly good ones, such as the shocking business gamble that pays off. Explanations that appeal to error or to special flair are far more popular than they deserve to be, because important gambles of the past easily become acts of genius or folly when their outcome is known. A well-documented psychological bias called the fundamental attribution error is a strong tendency to assign blame or credit to agents for actions and outcomes that are better explained by luck or by objective circumstances. Another bias, hindsight, distorts judgments so that outcomes that could not have been anticipated appear easily foreseeable in retrospect. Explanations for errors of judgment are not hard to come by. Finding reasons for judgments is, if anything, easier than finding causes for events. We can always invoke the motives of the people making the judgments. If that is not sufficient, we can blame their incompetence. And another explanation for poor judgments has become common in recent decades: psychological bias. A substantial body of research in psychology and behavioral economics has documented a long list of psychological biases: the planning fallacy, overconfidence, loss aversion, the endowment effect, the status quo bias, excessive discounting of the future, present bias, and many others, including, of course, biases for or against various categories of people. Much is known about the conditions under which each of these biases is likely to influence judgments and decisions, and a fair amount is known that would allow an observer of decision-making to recognize biased thinking in real time. A psychological bias is a legitimate causal explanation of a judgment error if the bias could have been predicted in advance or detected in real time. A psychological bias that is identified only after the fact can still provide a useful, if tentative, explanation if it also offers a prediction about the future. For example, the surprising rejection of a strong woman candidate for a position may suggest a more general hypothesis of gender bias that future appointments by the same committee will confirm or refute. Consider, in contrast, a causal explanation that applies only to one event. In that case, they failed, so they must have been overconfident. The statement is completely vacuous, but it provides an illusion of understanding that can be quite satisfying. Business school professor Phil Rosenzweig has convincingly argued that empty explanations in terms of biases are common in discussions of business outcomes. Their popularity attests to the prevalent need for causal stories that make sense of experience. Noise is statistical. As we noted in Chapter 12, our normal way of thinking is causal. We naturally attend to the particular, following and creating causally coherent stories about individual cases, in which failures are often attributed to errors and errors to biases. The ease with which bad judgments can be explained leaves no space for noise in our accounts of errors. The invisibility of noise is a direct consequence of causal thinking. Noise is inherently statistical. It becomes visible only when we think statistically about an ensemble of similar judgments. Indeed, it then becomes hard to miss. It is the variability in the backward-looking statistics about sentencing decisions and underwriting premiums. It is the range of possibilities when you and others consider how to predict a future outcome. It is the scatter of the hits on the target. Causally, noise is nowhere. Statistically, it is everywhere. Unfortunately, taking the statistical view is not easy. We effortlessly invoke causes for the events we observe, but thinking statistically about them must be learned and remains effortful. Causes are natural. Statistics are difficult. The result is a marked imbalance in how we view bias and noise as sources of error. If you have been exposed to any introductory psychology, you probably remember the illustrations in which a salient and richly detailed figure stands out from an indistinct background. Our attention is firmly fixed on the figure, even when it is small against the background. The figure-ground demonstrations are an apt metaphor for our intuitions about bias and noise. Bias is a compelling figure, while noise is the background to which we pay no attention. That is how we remain largely unaware of a large flaw in our judgment. Speaking of the sources of noise, we easily see differences in the average level of judgments, but how large is the pattern noise we do not see. You say this judgment was caused by biases, but would you say the same thing if the outcome had been different? And can you tell if there was noise? We are rightly focused on reducing biases. Let's also worry about reducing noise. Part 5. Improving Judgments. How can an organization improve the judgments its professionals make? In particular, how can an organization reduce judgment noise? If you were in charge of answering these questions, how would you go about it? A necessary first step is to get the organization to recognize that noise in professional judgments is an issue that deserves attention. To get to that point, we recommend a noise audit. See Appendix A on the bonus PDF for a detailed description. In a noise audit, multiple individuals judge the same problems. Noise is the variability of these judgments. There will be cases in which this variability can be attributed to incompetence. Some judges know what they are talking about, others do not. When there is such a skill gap, either in general or on certain types of cases, the priority should, of course, be to improve the deficient skills. But as we have seen, there can be a large amount of noise even in the judgments of competent and well-trained professionals. If the amount of system noise is worth addressing, replacing judgment with rules or algorithms is an option that you should consider, as it will eliminate noise entirely. But rules have their own problems, as we will see in Part 6. And even the most enthusiastic proponents of AI agree that algorithms are not, and will not soon be, a universal substitute for human judgment. The task of improving judgment is as urgent as ever, and it is the topic of this part of the book. A sensible way to improve judgments is, of course, to select the best possible human judges. At the shooting range, some shooters have an especially good aim. The same is true of any professional judgment task. The most highly skilled will be both less noisy and less biased. How to find the best judges is sometimes obvious. If you want to solve a chess problem, ask a grandmaster, not the authors of this book. But in most problems, the characteristics of superior judges are harder to discern. These characteristics are the subject of Chapter 18. Next, we discuss approaches to the reduction of judgment errors. Psychological biases are implicated in both statistical bias and noise. As we see in Chapter 19, there have been many attempts to counteract psychological biases, with some clear failures and some clear successes. We briefly review debiasing strategies and suggest a promising approach that, to our knowledge, has not been systematically explored: asking a designated decision observer to search for diagnostic signs that could indicate in real time that a group's work is being affected by one or several familiar biases. Appendix B on the bonus PDF provides an example of a bias checklist that a decision observer could use. We then proceed to our main focus in this part of the book: the fight against noise. We introduce the theme of decision hygiene, the approach we recommend to reduce noise in human judgments. We present case studies in 5 different domains. In each domain, we examine the prevalence of noise and some of the horror stories it generates. We also review the success, or the lack of success, of efforts to reduce noise. In each domain, of course, multiple approaches have been used. But for ease of exposition, each chapter emphasizes a single decision hygiene strategy. We start in Chapter 20 with the case of forensic science, which illustrates the importance of sequencing information. The search for coherence leads people to form early impressions based on the limited evidence available, and then to confirm their emerging prejudgment. This makes it important not to be exposed to irrelevant information early in the judgment process. In Chapter 21, we turn to the case of forecasting, which illustrates the value of one of the most important noise reduction strategies: aggregating multiple independent judgments. The wisdom of crowds principle is based on the averaging of multiple independent judgments, which is guaranteed to reduce noise. Beyond straight averaging, there are other methods for aggregating judgments, also illustrated by the example of forecasting. Chapter 22 offers a review of noise in medicine and efforts to reduce it. It points to the importance and general applicability of a noise reduction strategy we already introduced with the example of criminal sentencing. Judgment guidelines. Guidelines can be a powerful noise reduction mechanism because they directly reduce between-judge variability in final judgments. In Chapter 23, we turn to a familiar challenge in business life: performance evaluations. Efforts to reduce noise there demonstrate the critical importance of using a shared scale grounded in an outside view. This is an important decision hygiene strategy for a simple reason. Judgment entails the translation of an impression onto a scale, and if different judges use different scales, there will be noise. Chapter 24 explores the related but distinct topic of personnel selection, which has been extensively researched over the past 100 years. It illustrates the value of an essential decision hygiene strategy: structuring complex judgments. By structuring, we mean decomposing a judgment into its component parts, managing the process of data collection to ensure the inputs are independent of one another, and delaying the holistic discussion and the final judgment until all these inputs have been collected. We build on the lessons learned from the field of personnel selection to propose in Chapter 25 a general approach to option evaluation called the Mediating Assessments Protocol, or MAP for short. MAP starts from the premise that options are like candidates and describes schematically how structured decision-making, along with the other decision hygiene strategies previously mentioned, can be introduced in a typical decision process for both recurring and singular decisions. A general point before we embark: it would be valuable to be able to specify, and even to quantify, the likely benefits of each decision hygiene strategy in various contexts. It would also be valuable to know which of the strategies is most beneficial and how to compare them. When the information flow is controlled, to what extent is noise reduced? If the goal is to reduce noise, in practice, how many judgments should be aggregated? Structuring judgments can be valuable, but exactly how valuable is it in different contexts? Because the topic of noise has attracted little attention, these remain open questions, which research could eventually address. For practical purposes, the benefits of one or another strategy will depend on the particular setting in which it is being used. Consider the adoption of guidelines. They will sometimes produce massive benefits, as we will see in some medical diagnoses. In other settings, however, the benefits of adopting guidelines might be modest, perhaps because there is not a lot of noise to begin with, or perhaps because even the best possible guidelines do not reduce error much. In any given context, a decision maker should aspire to achieve a more precise understanding of the likely gains from each decision hygiene strategy and of the corresponding costs, which we discuss in Part 6. Chapter 18: Better Judges for Better Judgments. Thus far, we have mostly spoken of human judges without distinguishing among them. Yet it is obvious that in any task that requires judgment, some people will perform better than others will. Even a wisdom of crowds aggregate of judgments is likely to be better if the crowd is composed of more able people. An important question, then, is how to identify these better judges. Three things matter. Judgments are both less noisy and less biased when those who make them are well-trained, are more intelligent, and have the right cognitive style. In other words, good judgments depend on what you know, how well you think, and how you think. Good judges tend to be experienced and smart, but they also tend to be actively open-minded and willing to learn from new information. Experts and respect experts. It is almost tautological to say that the skill of judges affects the quality of their judgments. For instance, radiologists who are skilled are more likely to diagnose pneumonia correctly, And in forecasting world events, there are super forecasters who reliably outpredict their less than super peers. If you assemble a group of lawyers who are true specialists in some area of law, they are likely to make similar and good predictions about the outcome of common legal disputes in court. Highly skilled people are less noisy, and they also show less bias. These people are true experts at the tasks in question. Their superiority over others is verifiable thanks to the availability of outcome data. In principle, at least, we can choose a doctor, forecaster, or lawyer according to how often they have been right in the past. For obvious reasons, this approach may be difficult in practice. We don't recommend that you attempt to subject your family practitioner to a proficiency exam. As we have also noted, many judgments are not verifiable. Within certain boundaries, we cannot easily know or uncontroversially define the true value at which judgments are aiming. Underwriting and criminal sentencing fall in this category, as do wine tasting, essay grading, book and movie reviewing, and innumerable other judgments. Yet some professionals in these domains come to be called experts. The confidence we have in these experts' judgment is entirely based on the respect they enjoy from their peers. We call them respect experts. The term respect expert is not meant to be disrespectful. The fact that some experts are not subject to an evaluation of the accuracy of their judgments is not a criticism. It is a fact of life in many domains. Many professors, scholars, and management consultants are respect experts. Their credibility depends on the respect of their students, peers, or clients. In all these fields and many more, the judgments of one professional can be compared only with those of her peers. In the absence of true values to determine who is right or wrong, we often value the opinion of respect experts even when they disagree with one another. Picture, for instance, a panel on which several political analysts have sharply different perspectives on what caused a diplomatic crisis and how it will unfold. This disagreement is not unusual. It would not be a very interesting panel if they all agreed. All the analysts believe that there is a correct view and that their own view is the one closest to it. As you listen, you may find several of the analysts equally impressive and their arguments equally convincing. You cannot know then which of them is correct, and you may not even know later if their analyses are not formulated as clearly verifiable predictions. You know that at least some of the analysts are wrong because they are in disagreement, yet you respect their expertise. Or consider a different set of experts, not making predictions at all. Three moral philosophers, all of them well-trained, are gathered in a room. One of them follows Immanuel Kant, another Jeremy Bentham, and a third Aristotle. With respect to what morality requires, they disagree intensely. The issue might involve whether and when it is legitimate to lie, or the rights of animals, or the goal of criminal punishment. You listen closely. You might admire the clarity and precision of their thinking. You tend to agree with one philosopher, but you respect them all. Why do you do that? More generally, how do people who are themselves respected for the quality of their judgment decide to trust someone as an expert when there is no data to establish expertise objectively? What makes a respect expert? Part of the answer is the existence of shared norms or professional doctrine. Experts often obtain professional qualifications from professional communities and receive training and supervision in their organizations. Doctors who complete their residency and young lawyers who learn from a senior partner do not just learn the technical tools of their trade. They are trained to use certain methods and follow certain norms. Shared norms give professionals a sense of which inputs should be taken into account and how to make and justify their final judgments. In the insurance company, for instance, claims adjusters had no difficulty agreeing on and describing the relevant considerations that should be included in a checklist to assess a claim. This agreement, of course, did not stop the claims adjusters from varying widely in their claims assessments, because doctrine does not fully specify how to proceed. It is not a recipe that can be mechanically followed. Instead, doctrine leaves room for interpretation. Experts still produce judgments, not computations. That is why noise inevitably occurs. Even identically trained professionals who agree on the doctrine they are applying will drift away from one another in their application of it. Beyond a knowledge of shared norms, experience is necessary too. You can be a young prodigy if your specialty is chess, concert piano, or throwing the javelin, because results validate your level of performance. But underwriters, fingerprint examiners, or judges usually need some years of experience for credibility. There are no young prodigies in underwriting. Another characteristic of respect experts is their ability to make and explain their judgments with confidence. We tend to put more trust in people who trust themselves than we do in those who show their doubts. The confidence heuristic points to the fact that in a group, confident people have more weight than others, even if they have no reason to be confident. Respect experts excel at constructing coherent stories. Their experience enables them to recognize patterns, to reason by analogy with previous cases, and to form and confirm hypotheses quickly. They easily fit the facts they see into a coherent story that inspires confidence. Intelligence. Training, experience, and confidence enable respect experts to command trust. But these attributes do not guarantee the quality of their judgments. How can we know which experts are likely to make good judgments? There is good reason to believe that general intelligence is likely to be associated with better judgment. Intelligence is correlated with good performance in virtually all domains. All other things being equal, it is associated not only with higher academic achievement, but also with higher job performance. Many debates and misunderstandings arise in discussions of measures of intelligence or of general mental ability, GMA, the term now used in preference to intelligence quotient, or IQ. There are lingering misconceptions about the innate nature of intelligence. In fact, tests measure developed abilities, which are partly a function of heritable traits and partly influenced by the environment, including educational opportunities. Many people also have concerns about the adverse impact of GMA-based selection on identifiable social groups and the legitimacy of using GMA tests for selection purposes. We need to separate these concerns about the use of tests from the reality of their predictive value. Since the U.S. Army started using tests of mental ability more than a century ago, thousands of studies have measured the link between cognitive test scores and subsequent performance. The message that emerges from this mass of research is unambiguous. As one review put it, GMA predicts both occupational level attained and performance within one's chosen occupation, and does so better than any other ability, trait, or disposition, and better than job experience. Of course, other cognitive abilities matter too. More on this later. So do many personality traits, including conscientiousness and grit, defined as perseverance and passion in the pursuit of long-term goals. And yes, there are various forms of intelligence that GMA tests do not measure, such as practical intelligence and creativity. Psychologists and neuroscientists distinguish between crystallized intelligence, the ability to solve problems by relying on a store of knowledge about the world, including arithmetical operations, and fluid intelligence, the ability to solve novel problems. Yet for all its crudeness and limitations, GMA, as measured by standardized tests containing questions on verbal, quantitative, and spatial problems, remains by far the best single predictor of important outcomes. As the previously mentioned review adds, the predictive power of GMA is larger than most found in psychological research. The strength of the association between general mental ability and job success increases quite logically with the complexity of the job in question. Intelligence matters more for rocket scientists than it does for those with simpler tasks. For jobs of high complexity, the correlations that can be observed between standardized test scores and job performance are in the 0.5 range, PC equals 67%. As we have noted, a correlation of 0.5 indicates a very strong predictive value by social science standards. Especially in discussions of skilled professional judgments, an important and frequent objection to the relevance of intelligence measures is that all those who make such judgments are likely to be high GMA individuals. Doctors, judges, or senior underwriters are much more educated than the general population, and highly likely to score much higher on any measure of cognitive ability. You might reasonably believe that high GMA makes little difference among them, that it is merely the entry ticket into the pool of high achievers, not the source of achievement differences within that pool. This belief, although widespread, is incorrect. No doubt the range of GMAs found in a given occupation is wider at the bottom of the range of occupations than at the top. There are high GMA individuals in lower-level occupations, but almost no people with below-average GMA among lawyers, chemists, or engineers. From that perspective, therefore, high mental ability is apparently a necessary condition for gaining access to high-status professions. However, this measure fails to capture differences in achievement within these groups. Even among the top 1% of people as measured by cognitive ability, evaluated at age 13, exceptional outcomes are strongly correlated with GMA. Compared with those who are in the bottom quartile of this top 1%, those who are in the top quartile are 2 or 3 times more likely to earn a doctoral-level degree, publish a book, or be granted a patent. In other words, not only does the difference in GMA matter between the 99th percentile and the 80th or 50th, but it still matters a lot between the 99.88th percentile and the 99.13th. In another striking illustration of the link between ability and outcomes, a 2013 study focused on the CEOs of Fortune 500 companies and the 424 American billionaires, the top 0.0001% of Americans by wealth, it found, predictably, that these hyper-elite groups are composed of people drawn from the most intellectually able. But the study also found that within these groups, higher education and ability levels are related to higher compensation for CEOs and net worth for billionaires. Incidentally, famous college dropouts who become billionaires, such as Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, and Mark Zuckerberg, are the trees that hide the forest. Whereas about 1/3 of American adults have earned a college degree, 88% of billionaires did so. The conclusion is clear. GMA contributes significantly to the quality of performance in occupations that require judgment, even within a pool of high-ability individuals. The notion that there is a threshold beyond which GMA ceases to make a difference is not supported by the evidence. This conclusion, in turn, strongly suggests that if professional judgments are unverifiable but assumed to reach for an invisible bullseye, then the judgments of high-ability people are more likely to be close. If you must pick people to make judgments, picking those with the highest mental ability makes a lot of sense. But this line of reasoning has an important limitation. Since you cannot give standardized tests to everyone, you will have to guess who the higher GMA people are. And high GMA improves performance on many fronts, including the ability to convince others that you're right. People of high mental ability are more likely than others to make better judgments and to be true experts. But they are also more likely to impress their peers, earn others' trust, and become respect experts in the absence of any reality feedback. Medieval astrologers must have been among the highest GMA people of their time. It can be sensible to place your trust in people who look and sound intelligent, and who can articulate a compelling rationale for their judgments. But this strategy is insufficient and may even backfire. Are there then other ways to identify real experts? Do people with the best judgment have other recognizable traits? Cognitive style. Regardless of mental ability, people differ in their cognitive style or their approach to judgment tasks. Many instruments have been developed to capture cognitive styles. Most of these measures correlate with GMA and with one another, but they measure different things. One such measure is the Cognitive Reflection Test, CRT, made famous by the now ubiquitous question about the ball and the bat. A bat and ball cost $1.10 in total. The bat costs $1 more than the ball. How much does the ball cost? Other questions that have been proposed to measure cognitive reflection include this one. If you're running a race and you pass the person in second place, what place are you in? CRT questions attempt to measure how likely people are to override the first and wrong answer that comes to mind. 10 cents for the ball and bat question, and first for the race example. Lower CRT scores are associated with many